Hello, I'm Anne Mossop, Sydney Writers Festival Artistic Director. This episode of our podcast was recorded as part of the 2024 Sydney Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy the conversation.
I'm going to sit at the edge of my seat because it's that kind of book and it's going to be that kind of conversation. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Sydney Writers Festival 2024. My name is Rowana Gonsalves, and I'm delighted to welcome you all here to a conversation with Abraham Varghese, the author of The Covenant of Water. I would like to acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, the traditional custodians of this land, and pay my respects to the elders past and present, and to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who are here with us today. Abraham Varghese is a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop and the author of books including My Own Country and The Tennis Partner. His most recent novel, the book that we're going to be talking about this evening, is The Covenant of Water, and it was selected for Oprah's book club and has already spent 6 months on the New York Times bestseller list. His 2009 novel, Cutting for Stone, sold more than 1.5 million copies in the US alone. And it was translated into more than 20 languages and is being adapted for film by Anonymous Content. Abraham was awarded the National Humanities Medal in 2016 and has received 5 honorary degrees and lives and practices medicine in Stanford, California, where he is the Linda R. Mayer and Joan F. Lane Provostial Professor and Vice Chair of the Department of Medicine at the Stanford University School of Medicine. So not only is he a doctor, he's also a professor of medicine, vice chair of the Department of Medicine, and he writes best-selling books that are on the New York Times bestseller list for months and months. Welcome, Abraham. It's such an honor to have you here with us, even if on Zoom. Thank you for the gift of your writing, and thank you for writing this book.
Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure. I must say it's a bit heartbreaking for me to be have come all this way and then to have come down with COVID yesterday. But the good news is I travel with Paxlovid and I'm a lot better today. And anyway, I apologize for not being there with you in person. But thank you so much for having me. And thank you for coming.
There's a huge and a wonderful audience here, Abraham. I'll tell you what the publisher's website says about this book, and then I'll tell you why I love it. So according to the publisher's website, spanning the years 1900 to 1977, The Covenant of Water follows a family in southern India that suffers a peculiar affliction. In every generation, at least one person dies by drowning. And this book is set in Kerala. Many of you have either been to Kerala, are from Kerala, or have heard of Kerala. It's a place where water is everywhere. At the turn of the century, a 12-year-old girl, grieving the death of her father, is sent by boat to her wedding, where she will marry her 40-year-old husband and see him, actually. She will meet him for the first time. From this poignant beginning, the young girl and future matriarch, known as Big Amachi, will witness unthinkable changes at home and at large over the span of her extraordinary life, full of the joys and trials of love and the struggles of hardship. I told you it's going to be like an edge of the seat kind of conversation. A shimmering evocation of a lost India and of the passage of time itself. The Covenant of Water, says the publisher, is a hymn to progress in medicine and to human understanding, and a humbling testament to the hardships undergone by past generations for the sake of those alive today. Imbued with humor, deep emotion, and the essence of life, it is one of the most masterful literary novels published in recent years. I love this book for many reasons. It's set in a part of the world that's very dear to me, close to where I grew up. It's a love letter to Malayalis, It's a love letter to Kerala. It's a love letter to medicine. It's a critique of the caste system and of the virtue signaling of the upper castes. It's a critique of the way indigenous people are treated, a rendering of the effects of the loss of land rights for the Paniyan of Wayanad in Kerala. There are many echoes here in Australia, as we all know. It's a critique of religion, but it's not a critique of faith in its purest sense of the term. It's a whopper of a book, 715 pages. I must admit, I thought, okay, I'll just skip a few pages just get to the end, you know, but life's too short for boring books. But actually, I could not. I tried to skip, but I skipped a sentence and I could not, I needed to read it before I went to the next sentence, because really, Abraham Varghese is a master plotter. I don't know about in real life, but definitely on the page. A masterful storyteller. I could not skip a few pages, even though that was my intention to get through the book. I had the pleasure of enjoying this book over 3 or 4 days, but you can prolong the pleasure, you know, you read it over the course of many days and immerse yourself in the absolutely stunning evocation of place that Abraham has rendered in the book. Every word is essential to the book. It's a book about secrets. It's a book about water. It's a book about hands. Abraham, I love the way you weave in these three concerns, making them swirl through the book. The biblical references through the hands of doubting Thomas, Saint Thomas, who landed in India in the first century AD and converted many Indians to Christianity 2,000 years ago. Abraham, I'd love for you to read from the book, but first, would you please tell us a little bit about the world of the book, why you chose to set this story in these particular places? Because it's not just set in India. It's set in other parts, in other particular part of the world as well. So I'd love for you to begin by telling us a little bit about why this story, why these places, why these times?
Sure. First, let me say, I love what you just said about how it's a critique of religion, but not of faith. And I think I was trying to write a book that paid tribute to some of the heroic women in my life, especially my two grandmothers, who were, you know, I think all of us know people like this who are heroic, but unsung. You know, the world will never know about their strength. Both these women suffered great adversity, lost sons, you know, to typhoid fever in one case, rabies in the other. And yet they went on and they became sort of pillars of sort of goodness and strength in their families. And I wanted to sort of follow their lives, if you like. So setting it between 1900 and 1977 was very deliberate. And when you tell a story like that, multiple generations, you almost can't, you know, you have to be true to the times. And it was a time of two world wars, a tremendous change for India, in that India was emancipated after, you know, centuries of colonial rule. And then it was also a time of great medical progress. So, you know, trying to get all those things in together was the ambition of the novel, very, very crudely. But I must say that, as a physician, one of the great joys of practicing medicine for the last 40 years has been to sort of see how diseases that we just had names for in medical school but didn't really understand, over the course of decades became, you know, much more clearly understood, the molecular basis defined, and eventually, you know, biological therapies developed. And I wanted to have that happen during the course of the novel, in a sense, with this one disease. So that was the grand ambition. I didn't quite know how I would pull it off. You make me sound like I had a great master plan. We can talk about that. Did you? And you said you wanted me to read something from the book. Is
yes,
that right,
please.
Nana?
Yes.
So, you know, I thought I would read a paragraph, and I should tell you that I've always admired it when writers manage to foreshadow the whole book in the first paragraph of the novel. Now, I clearly had no such talent to do that, so I had to wait till about page 15 or 16 to come close to that. And so in this paragraph that I'm going to read to you, we've begun in the head of a 12-year-old bride, as you described, on her way to the wedding. But all of a sudden, in this paragraph, after she's been married, we suddenly make this leap forward where, you know, she's now a grandmother and looking back. And in that momentary, you know, leap forward and looking back, I tried to foreshadow the whole book. And before I read it, I should also say that, parenthetically, that I recorded the audiobook for this novel, which is not common. In fact, I would say all of us as readers should have a little red flag go off if you ever hear of an author reading their own fiction. Just because, you know, what do we know about performing a book? It's no accident that Meryl Streep just recorded Tom Lake by my friend Ann Patchett, or that Brad Pitt recorded Cormac McCarthy's All the Pretty Horses, because these folks know how to present. So I said to my publishers, I want to audition for this. And if you think I can be as good as some of the people you're going to line up, then I'd like to do it. Because I was worried that people would mangle all the ethnic terms in there. And I just didn't think I could stomach that. And so I was lucky to be picked. I learned a tremendous amount. And I'm telling you this because if my reading sounds a bit over the top, if it sounds a bit thespian, it's because I was taught how to do some of these things, how to change the pitch of my voice to indicate a male or a female on the page, and, you know, accents, but not to overdo the accents. So with that preamble, here goes. Here's that paragraph. Happened is happened, our young bride will say when she becomes a grandmother, and when her granddaughter, her Nisik, asks for a story about their ancestors. The little girl has heard rumors that theirs is a genealogy chock full of secrets, and that her ancestors included slavers, murderers, and a defrocked priest. Child, happened has happened, and the past is past, and furthermore, it's different every time I remember it. I'll tell you about the future, the one you will make. But the child insists. Where should the story begin? With doubting Thomas, who insisted on seeing Christ's wounds before he'd believe? With other martyrs to the faith? No, what the child clamors for is the story of their own family, of the widower's house into which her grandmother married, a landlocked dwelling in a land of water, a house full of mysteries. But such memories are woven from gossamer threads, and time eats holes in the fabric, and these she must darn with myth and fable. The grandmother is certain of a few things. A tale that leaves its imprint on a listener is unavoidably about families. A tale that leaves its imprint on a listener and tells the truth about how the world lives is about families, victories, and wounds, and their departed, including the ghosts that linger. A story must offer instructions for living in God's realm, where joy never spares one from sorrow. A good story goes beyond what a forgiving God cares to do. It reconciles families. It unburdens them of secrets whose bond is stronger than blood. But in the revealing of the secrets, as in their keeping, secrets can tear a family apart.
Oh.
Thank you.
It's gorgeous. And those of you who have read the book will know how beautifully this foreshadows what is to come. But Abraham, it also functions as a hook. It functions as a hook for us as readers. We want to know, oh, what's going on here? What are these secrets? And what has happened in that time between the older Mariamma, Big Amachi, who becomes Big Amachi, from the time of her wedding to now when she's saying these words to the granddaughter, the time that has lapsed. What's happened in that time? And that's the book, isn't it? So it just functions like this beautiful hook.
Yes, you're right. In a sense, that is the whole book, is the three generations between the 12-year-old bride and the granddaughter who grows up to be a physician. I must say, I think there are several books. To me, one of them that was sort of risky was beginning with a 12-year-old bride. You know, the second line of the book is the 12-year-old bride's mother saying to her, "The saddest day of a girl's life is the day of her wedding. But God willing, after that, it gets better." And, you know, it's to start with a 12-year-old girl is dangerous, because for most readers, contemporary readers, you know, it's shocking. And yet, that was the true story of my great-grandmother and to some degree my grandmother. And, of course, most of them were actually marrying 12 or 13-year-old boys. They were just becoming children in a large household with many other children. And paradoxically, their mother-in-laws became closer to them than their own mothers, because they really got to know them over such a long time. And for a girl, it was the saddest day of their life, because marriage also meant that you were leaving this house that you belonged to, and you would no longer be a part of that house, and you would now be a member of another house. And to this day, I've attended, you know, the ceremony where the bride leaves for the church, both in America and Kerala, and there's tears, you know, there's weeping, because even though there's a great occasion about to happen, this moment, the day and leaving to the church is actually in its own way quite sad. So I was playing against that grain. I was playing against the secrets. I was playing against the unfolding of history with all its difficulties, two wars and British occupation. So lots of hooks, if you like.
Yeah, lots of hooks. Lots of hooks. But I just want to say that your beginning with a 12-year-old girl was not shocking to me. It worked as a hook in a different way. I thought, oh my God, here we go again, child marriage, India, melodrama. But actually, the more I read, even just on that first page, the complexity with which and the love with which you have breathed these characters into being, that was the hook for me from the first page onwards. You can see the love that the writer has for every single character. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, your process of imagining these characters into being with so much love and empathy.
Yeah, actually, I mean, I meant to say that the 12-year-old bride was a hook in the sense that, as you said, conventionally, all of us will think, oh, my God, here we go. But I wanted to play against the grain, because she was marrying a 40-year-old widower who had children. And for it to evolve into the most, you know, a lovely love story. Yeah. I'm biased, so I shouldn't brag about my own love story there. But for it to evolve into a really wonderful love story, as I see it, I thought was the challenge, and what made it really interesting as a writer. And yet, I was also this time telling the true story of my great grandmother, who I never knew, and she was married at 12 to an older widower, who basically had a few children, but over time, they had children together. And by all accounts, since I never met her, I mean, people still talked about how wonderful and humorous and rich that marriage was, a model for people around. And naturally, he did not live as long as she did. But she sort of carried the torch of that marriage for such a long time. And that was, you know, a joy. You ask about the characters developing. And, you know, I think I wanted to save time on this book by not spending the 8 years I spent on the last book. I said, I'm going to be very efficient. I'm going to have this all plotted out. But, you know, a strange thing happens when you develop your characters and, you get to know them. And especially when you put the character under some pressure, you know, you have this moment in mind where they're under pressure in some way. There is an axiom in writing that character is determined by decisions taken under pressure. Yeah. That's true of life too, I suppose. You know, you put someone under pressure, the particular decision they make versus somebody else is what makes them unique. And so I would put my characters under pressure, and I would almost immediately know that they were not going to take the path that I chose. Mm. And so I had this wonderful whiteboard in my living room with the whole plot of the book lined up, excuse me. And I would suddenly realize I just can't go that way. And so I would have to take a photograph of my whiteboard, erase it, and start again. And so I got to know my characters quite organically by watching them unfold. And I have the greatest respect for writers who know the whole story and pretty much write it. I've had to do it this somewhat more painful, iterative way. But I always felt that if something that suddenly was happening to a character was surprising to me, I don't mean cheap surprise, but surprise in terms of a insight into a character's heart or what made them who they were, then it would also be compelling to the reader.
Yes. Oh, yeah, for sure. It's just, to put it mildly, it is a compelling book. it's just superb. From what you were just saying, I think it's your particular stance on power that that enables us as readers to encounter this book as an edge of the seat kind of book. And now it makes sense, the way that you've just talked about, the way you created characters, let them develop organically, not in this way that you had planned on the whiteboard. I feel like you have this particular stance on the accumulation of power, with whether it is systemic power, societal power, religious, the power that institutional religion has, or the power that one has over oneself. You are constantly, as a writer, making sure that this power is not held on to for very long, whether it's for individual characters, it's with individual characters, or whether it's systemic. So, for example, and also the idea of power needing glory to be legitimate. The bishops, there's a scene in the book, I think later on, I'm not giving away the ending by saying this, but there's a hospital that needs to be erected. The bishops on the committee are more interested in their names on the plaque and in ordering the plaque for the hospital's foundation rather than ordering the medical supplies. And because they understand very keenly that you need glory in order for power to survive. But I was just interested in your ideas on power, because it comes throughout the book. Your critique of religion, but not faith. Your critique of the caste system. I love that scene where, again, I don't want to give too much away, but there are these upper caste Brahmins who think that they're being really generous, but then they put in their place by a particular character. I won't give it away. You read, have the pleasure of reading it for yourselves. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the way power is subverted in your book all the time, I feel, and that's what makes it so rich and such a beautiful, engaging read, one of the things that makes it so.
Well, I'm probably going to disappoint you, Rana, but on the other hand, I think as a wonderful writer yourself, you will agree in part. And that is, you know, I have this theory that, you know, when you write a book, or where does a book really exist? I think a writer provides the words, there's that one arc. The reader provides their imagination. Yeah. And somewhere in middle space, this, with any luck, this fictional dream begins to take form and shape. If the writer provides too many words, the reader feels kind of robbed. You know, they're like, they don't have the joy of imagining. Mm. On the other hand, if the writer doesn't provide enough words, then the whole thing becomes mysterious. You know, like, you know, Finnegan's Wake. Who the hell knows what James Joyce was trying to do there? I've given up, you know. But having done that, I feel that I'm not responsible for what readers make of it. I've been humbled by getting PhD theses or a master's thesis on my last novel, where the candidate was writing extensively about my use of symbolism and archetype. And I was thinking, my God, if only I was that clever, if I really knew how to do all those things. So similarly, I have to confess, when you talk about my use of power, as you know, one isn't consciously thinking of any of those things as one writes. In fact, I was trying to be true to the times. You know, if I just think about my childhood and my visits to my grandparents, there were inequities of power that I saw and was, you know, embarrassed for. And my parents saw, but had been so used to it that it wasn't, they understood my point of view, but didn't really know what could be done. And my grandparents obviously saw none of it. So I think I was just trying to be true to the times, true to the colonial era, true to the, you know, hierarchies of power that exist in all our lives. But I don't think I ever consciously sat there and said, today I'm going to pursue the theme of power. I don't wish, I guess, in a mean way, but just to say, I'm really not that smart, and I'm just glad that it all sort of seems that way to you, which is incredibly important to me. Thank you.
But it's also a being incredibly true to the imaginative capacity. That's why your characters do unexpected things and surprise you as the writer, because you're open to them almost taking on a life of their own. But it's you being true to the imagination. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that's well said. I think when you really inhabit a character well, then things emerge in the specific. The specific becomes a demonstration of the archetypal, or moment, if you like. So I never write in terms of archetypes. I never write in terms of rules. But characters begin to embody them. And for me, the great joy of reading is to read about a novel set in a completely foreign culture to me, and yet in the behavior of these very different people to see echoes of all the truths that you and I know to be, somehow we sort of know this is right, this is true, this is what our life feels like, And I think it's that recognition that makes it such a joy to read. If I've become a writer, which I never set out to be, that's another story, but it's because I love this feeling of entering a world and having, decades pass, centuries pass, wars and this and that, and you put the book down and it's Tuesday. Mm-hmm. That feeling of being transported, of stopping time, maybe because time is so ever-present in medicine, the joy of being able to stop time in that fashion is truly a delight.
I'd love for you to talk a little bit more about that link between the craft of practicing medicine and the craft of writing. I know that is something that you have spent a lot of time thinking about, but also in the writing of this book, if you know anyone who wants to go to medical school, please do them a favor and get them this book. It's it made me want to become a doctor of medicine. It's too late. But I think it's just this beautiful rendering of the vocation of being a doctor of medicine. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that link.
You're very kind. Thank you. Rana, I think I actually was always a reader. I didn't really have much other strengths in my schooling. I was a very indifferent student, but I loved to read. And I came to medicine because of a book. And I think that's fairly typical of a certain generation of physicians. In the UK and the Commonwealth, it was often The Citadel by A.J. Cronin. In America, it was a book called Arrowsmith. For me, it was a book called Of Human Bondage. And it almost doesn't matter what the medical element was. I felt the strong sense of being called to medicine. I saw medicine as a romantic and passionate pursuit. And I really haven't stopped seeing it that way. And the only reason I became a writer is I was living through an incredible moment in HIV in a small town in Tennessee. I'm an infectious disease specialist, and I wrote a scientific paper describing a very unique happening in that small town, which I thought was happening in every small town. And the scientific paper got a lot of attention, but I felt that the language of science didn't really begin to capture the tragic nature of that voyage, didn't begin to capture the grief of the families, didn't begin to capture my own heartache at watching this unfold again and again in young men's lives, primarily before we had treatment. And so that's how I became a writer. I must say that I found as a writer that since I came to it fairly late in life, in my late 30s, that I had life experience to draw on. I always think of what is medicine but life plus plus, life on steroids, life lived at its most acute. I mean, the privilege we have of watching people in their most crucial moments, it's overwhelming. It's just tremendous. And writing has been a wonderful way to sort of try to process that. You know, I always think that I write in order to understand what I'm thinking. And I can just take a walk by the river and try to understand it. But there's something magical about the act of writing. Call it the muse, the right brain, call it, you know, the gods, whatever you want. It is completely mysterious to me, and I love it for that reason. I will say that the craft of medicine, especially as an internist, you know, the ability to sort of take all these disparate details and, you know, bring them together in one whole, apply Occam's razor to many different observations you're making, you know, always trying to create synthesis, one diagnosis, that has been helpful. Within medicine, one of my passions is really examining the body carefully, reading the body as a text, if you like. So I think that kind of attention to detail has definitely helped in the training of being a writer, I suppose. It has helped both ways, though. I think being a writer has helped me become a better physician because I'm more sort of aware of what's unfolding. I'm not in terms of parasitizing what I see, but just more of aware of how human beings are because I've taken the time to try and really trying to digest that in a way you only get through writing. Mm-hmm. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Thank you for sharing that with us. I'm a very appreciative audience for what you just said.
I wish I could see them. I can see you. You'll have to describe them to me later. But really, God bless you all for being there. I know it's disappointing that I'm not there in person. I feel it too.
On a slightly different note, as you were speaking, I could hear Scotland in your voice. Tell us about Digby, the character of Digby.
Yeah, you know, I don't really have any reason for Scotland in my voice, except in the audiobook I took pains to learn the Glaswegian accent and, you know, things like that. But people have asked me, you know, in fact, in India, a journalist asked me, did you put in a Scottish character in order to appeal to Western readers? And I felt a bit offended by that question. I said, you know, here's the irony. You and I are speaking in the English language, and the great majority of readers who are going to read your piece as well as my book are, you know, people who read in English and, you know, are sort of steeped in that tradition, the British tradition. So it really wasn't catering to anybody. It's catering to you as much as it is to the Western reader in some other country. But more than that, it was also catering to, you know, it was on catering. I was being true to the times.
Yeah.
I was being true to the times. So I was just being true to the times. You know, if you think about medicine in India, 1900 to 1977, it was all driven by the British. The Indian Medical Service was British, with Indian trainees and writers coming up slowly through the system. So to have a Scottish character, to have a Swiss estate manager, to have a, you know, English surgeon or Anglo-Indian characters, it was all very, very organic and true to the era. I wasn't really, again, my apologies that people read into things much more than I'm capable of, but I'm happy when they do wrong. That is their interpretation, like the person who wrote the master's thesis, God forbid, he's not wrong. And the fact that he saw it that way, that was his fictional dream. That's what it meant to him.
Yeah.
And more power to him.
Yeah. And just a plug for people who do write master's theses and PhD theses, this is how literature stays alive, through scholarship. So please read the literature, but also read the scholarship on the literature. That's why we're still reading Finnegan's Wake, because people have written about it all these years. A beautiful comment here. Someone has said, D. Reddy has said, as someone who grew up in Madras, your paragraph describing the Madras sea breeze makes me laugh and cry and rejoice. Thank you. And another comment. As a physician myself, says this anonymous commenter, you've depicted the awe and nostalgia of studying anatomy in medical school. Just wonderful. A question from Anthony Z. Thanks for your wonderful book and audiobook, beautifully narrated over 36 hours. did reading aloud provoke new feelings or reflections on writing and storytelling?
Yes, I mean, in the sense that, well, let me answer the last question. Before I get to that question, let me just say, I'm so honored by those comments about Madras and about being a physician, although most physicians would agree that when we were doing anatomy, there was nothing joyful or nostalgic or, you know, about it. But looking back, it was a rite of passage that most of us look back on with something, hopefully nostalgia. And they say you should write what you know. I spent significant time in Madras, in Kerala, in Africa, the topic of my last book. So I tend to stay with things that I can truly speak to. The research alone only gets you so far. I must say that when I have never gone back and read any of my books, only because the impulse is irresistible to take up a pencil and make corrections. So I'm robbed of reading experience because I'm too self-conscious and critical of what I've produced. But in this case, recording the audiobook, I was forced to sort of live the story, but not even that alone, with a wonderful producer and a studio technician. And, you know, when I was revising, there were many times I'd be in tears every single time I got to certain places, even though I knew what was going to happen. I'd be in tears, you know, but this time it was me, the producer, the technician, all of us in tears. And I think it's made me much more conscious of the audio experience. I mean, I've always been a writer, I imagine, very much like you, who reads their work aloud, or in my case, I have my loved one read it to me, which allows me to experience it and immediately see the flaws. I think recording the audiobook made me even more conscious of the importance of how it really sounds, even more than the way it looks. How does it sound?
Oh, the dialogue is exceptional. It's just superb, I have to say, the dialogue throughout the book, when characters speak directly to each other. Just superb, and, you know, it's just a testament to the care that you have taken over every single word and sentence. A couple of questions. One from someone who's asking, any advice for someone trying to be a doctor and a writer too?
Interesting. You know, I must say that, let me tell you the advice I give to people who want to be writers, and everyone thinks I'm being facetious when I say this, but I'm not. I love my day job. I love what I do in medicine. It's not a painful thing. You know, there are painful aspects to it, more so, I think, now than when we started. But I think that the advice I give to writers people who want to be writers is, get a good day job, one that you love. Because I think there's nothing harder on a writer than having to, you know, churn out a book to pay your kids' college tuition or something like that. And I've been spared that. I can take my time writing a book. I don't really have to, you know, be in a great hurry. Don't get me wrong. I want my books to do very well. I you know, it's important to me. But if nothing happened, I'd still be, you know, happy. I would still feel like I hadn't been robbed of anything. So my advice to physicians, I think all of us, many, many physicians, all physicians perhaps, have a novel in them. And in another context, some famous writer said, everybody has a novel in them, but most of those novels should stay inside them. Yes. I don't think that's accurate. Yes. I think most people have a novel in them, but it takes an extraordinary amount of work, as you know. In my case, years of, you know, writing in certain directions and realizing, well, that's not the novel. So at least for me, it's a slow process, much more complicated than most things I do. But on the other hand, if you do a little bit every day and you keep progressing, at the end of it, you'll have some pages, and hopefully that they're good. So I wouldn't discourage anybody, but I would do it for the right reason. I mean, I feel incredibly blessed that my books are still in print, that they're well received, you know. It's by no means a given. I should also tell you, just to give the physicians there a dose of reality, I had no real support in my first couple of jobs in medical schools where I was writing. It was something I did secretly. No one wanted to know about it. They didn't claim it. They saw it as a distraction. Even when the book did pretty well, it was like, well, why is he doing all this stuff? You know. So it's only when I finally came to Stanford that they saw it as a valuable sort of pursuit, academic pursuit, if you like, the equivalent of my colleagues' research. And so that was wonderful. Also with this book, I got a contract for it about 12 years ago or so, and from a major publisher with a big advance. But I just felt like ultimately I was too slow for them. The publisher wanted so many pages. They didn't really seem to care about what the story was in those pages as much as the number of pages. And I finally had to break the contract and leave that publisher, owe them a big advance they gave me, but I'm on my way to paying that off soon. And also had to shop around for another publisher. It was really a lot more angst than anybody wants in their life. So I feel incredibly fortunate to be talking to you and have a live audience in Australia. Mm-hmm. I had reached a point, if this book ever got into print, I would have been so happy. I had reached that point of desperation. So to have all the magical things. I'm sorry, I can't control this light. There's a muse, there's a devil in there somewhere. So to have this done, all these wonderful things happened to the book has been pure gravy for me. Enormously grateful.
Well, thank you. We are grateful to you for writing the book and for the gift of your writing. There's a question from Sanchana who says, and you've responded to this in different ways already, but I will ask it. Can you share a bit about your writing process and how you balance that with practicing medicine? So I suppose on a day-to-day basis, how do you balance the actual practice of medicine with the practice of writing?
I think when I started off, especially with the first book, after Iowa, I took a break from I gave up my tenured position, cashed it all in, cashed my retirement, went to Iowa. But when I came back, my first teaching job back in academic medicine was in El Paso, Texas, Texas Tech University, a small medical school. And all they wanted from me was to be a clinician, see people in my specialty and take care of students and residents. And the evenings and nights were my own. The weekends were my own. No pressure to produce NIH grants and all that. But I was a very busy clinician. But in a strange way, I felt that the busyness at work just brought an acuteness to the writing because I only had so many hours to do it in. I didn't have infinite time. And so in a funny way, when I was busiest, earliest in my career, I felt the writing was just the most pressured in a nice way, so to speak. I'm much more senior now. I have a fair number of administrative duties. When I'm on the wards as a consultant, your equivalent here, running a ward team, then I'm very busy and there is no time to do anything else. But it comes in 1 or 2 week blocks. So there are many times when I can block out time but everybody asks if you have a routine, you write so many hours a day. I wish I did. I think I write when I can and when it moves me. And if only I weren't so lazy and were able to write every single day for so many hours, I would be more productive. But, I've just had to do it when I can and when the mood strikes, which is often not ideal. I should also say, everybody, I write on the computer, but then I edit on paper. So even though the computer gives you this illusion that you have, you can move anywhere in the novel, which you can only do so pretty much 1 or 2 pages at a time. And I think there's something wonderful about every day or all the time, taking the whole manuscript and saying, these 50 sheets really belong here, and these 100 sheets are great, but they don't belong in this novel. And, they go in the round file under your desk. And I think you need the weight of the paper, the tactile thing for me, to sort of feel what you're doing with this book. The computer gives you that illusion, but it also robs you of some kind of reality.
Yeah. We're almost out of time, but I want to ask one more question that came in from the audience, and that is about your next book. Are we allowed to know what the next book's about or how you're going with it?
May I say how I used to get very offended by that question, because my immediate gut reaction would be, well, what's wrong with the book I just wrote? You know?
It's so good that we want more.
I realize that's very disingenuous, and it's been a year. But I must say, I don't really feel this compulsion to. That is a very unique thing, I think, to our society, is that you have a number one hit on the top of the charts, a song, let's say. Immediately, you're expected to follow it up. And, I know I will write, but the events around this book have been so magical that I don't know if I could ever have this happen in just this kind of magical way again. And I won't be under any illusion. In many ways, I think that's what happened with the last novel. It did so well. The publisher saw me as this golden goose that's going to lay a golden egg. I succumbed to the illusion. I took the big advance. And I think I'm much better off just, understanding that I will always write. Hopefully, pretty soon, something will start to take shape and take form. But I certainly don't feel pressure to come up with another novel tomorrow. If it all ends right with this novel, it would have been a great accomplishment for me personally. I really wouldn't want much more.
Oh, that's beautiful. Such a beautiful, appreciative audience for you, Abraham. I want to finish up with a line, not from the book, but from the notes. And the notes themselves are a masterclass in humility and in also acknowledging what many writers and artists have said in the past, that all art is made from other art. And very few writers have the humility or the honesty to admit that. But here you have extensive notes by Abraham Varghese referencing the influences that have fed his imaginative labor in this work. But I just want to end this session with this line that you have used from the poet E.E. Cummings. And you've taken that line but done something beautiful with it, where one of the characters expresses the same sentiments in different words. I won't tell you those words. You'll have to find them for yourselves in the book. But the words by E. Cummings that you were influenced by were, "I carry your heart with me." And I think that's such a beautiful line. I carry your heart with me. And it calls to mind and it resonates with what you said, Abraham, at the start of this session, which is that magical bond between the writer, the reader, and the work. And that bond actually is predicated on love and empathy and trust. And so I want to say thank you so much. Thank you so much for the gift of your beautiful work. To the audience, I cannot recommend this book highly enough. It's a long book, but it will give you such delight and such pleasure. I laughed and cried at many points in the book. You are a masterful storyteller, Abraham. Thank you so much. Thank you for being with us today.
May I just say, writers like you and me, we wouldn't exist without readers. And thank goodness for festivals like this one. The City Writers Festival is just incredible. You guys are incredible for coming and supporting it. So thank you so much. Thank you for having me here. And happy reading ahead for you.
Thank you, Abraham.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe and to rate our channel.